Each week, nearly a dozen movies are released theatrically. 40 films a month, more than 400 a year. That's a plethora of cinema. Too much cinema. You'd have to be an addict to see all that. But don't fret. We've got you covered. This is Cinematics.
Hey everyone, what's up? It's a new week, new batch of movies for Cinematics. This is Cinematics episode 238. We are covering some new movies that are opening on the week of Friday, April 19th. Movies include Dusk for a Hitman, The Coffee Table, Blood for Dust, and Photographic Justice. I'm joined by my betters, Eric Holmes, Bruce Parkey. Let's start with Bruce Parkey first. Again, our weekly mission is to find cinematic gems on a given, on a weekly basis. Sometimes we fall short of those goals. What about this week? Are there something you're excited about among the batch of new movies that are coming out, or maybe your box pick? Is there something really good for the listener?
Maybe not. I don't know. I'm on the fence on a few things this week.
Okay, Bruce is on the fence on a few things. Here's spoiler alert: Bruce's box pick is Cinema Paradiso, one of my all-time favorite films. And when I say that, it's a nostalgic pick, because this movie really shaped me as an 18-year-old back in 1989. I'm not 52. The only shape I have is the pear shape from me being overweight. I am not that young, spindly, or what, wiry, idealistic youth. Let's see if Bruce, who is, I'm going to say Bruce is also 52. He's going to give his 52-year-old POV on Cinema Party. So I think just based on that pick, we have some good stuff to cover this week. What about you, Eric Holmes? First of all, how's the sauce? Second of all, are there gems this week?
Sauce, the reviews are exactly the same as they were last week. 6.9 stars on all of them.
Is Dr. Sauce, aka Eric Holmes, are you working on a new batch? Are you dreaming up of new ingredients to put on different sauces? Or is your collection of sauces already set in stone? Do you know what you're going to go to market with, all that stuff down the road?
The initial batches, I already know. As far as dreaming them up, that's usually my sister. She'll usually wake up and go, I had a dream of this mixed with this. I'm like, yeah, we can make that work. And then we put it together and I was like, that was pretty good. So okay. My sister is the one that usually comes up with the oddball sauces. The blueberry jalapeno one was probably one of the first ones. And yeah. I think that's either that or the bacon bourbon one seem to be the two favorites.
Bacon bourbon. That sounds really good. Bruce Perky, they have to go to market soon, right? They got to figure out how they can make a profit on these sauces, because shipping around the world is expensive. I don't know, Bruce, what sauce would you like from Eric? You can't have the ham slime, though. You can't have ham slime.
I'm still rooting for the hot one. What is that? Green habanero? Was it habanero?
That was basically just green chili. Like, so for when we did the food truck, we still do pull out the food truck once in a while, but a lot of what we make is the smoked pork green chili. And I just made that into a sauce minus the pork part. It's just the green chili part, but yeah, it's real spicy, but tastes just like our green chili does.
Okay. That's some very good. I'm really excited to taste some of the stuff that you and your sister have been making at least several months, right? You guys have been hard at work on this. Also hard at work as part of our Cinematics Facebook group family is Joseph Bridges, and he's going to, even though his voice will not be heard, his audible voice will not be heard on this episode, his spirit and his influence will be heard, because Eric Holmes has the second installment of Famously Anonymous segment. Eric Holmes, will we be able to guess who this person is when you challenge us?
Probably not.
Oh.
However,
you have no faith in me and Bruce. Is that correct?
I've never even heard of this person, which is okay. Kind of the point. Yeah, Joseph Bridges, like once that episode aired, and this was like 2 weeks ago, Joseph Bridges sent me an email and gave me this person's name. It's like, I think this is perfect. He didn't even give me like a list. He just said, just check out their IMDb. And I did. And holy crap. All right. This person's most of their credits are a second unit assistant director, but they also have 25 producer credits. And I'll just start naming through them. We got Born on the 4th of July, The Doors, JFK, Age of Innocence, A Bronx Tale, Casino, Horse Whisperer, Bring Out the Dead, Legend of Bagger Vance, Gangs of New York, Aviator, Shutter Island, Black Swan, Unbroken, Unsane.
So this is a producer.
Chicago 7, In the Heights, Ferrari. Yeah, these are the producer credits. And I'm not even listing off the second unit assistant director credits, which they're Avengers Endgame, Spider-Man Far From Home,
Is this an actual director? So this is producer credits, assistant director. What about feature, like real director? He or she is the captain of the ship.
There are no director credits. These are all second unit, assistant director, and producer credits. There are actor credits. Most of the actor credits, I believe, are they probably played bit parts in the movies they were producing. But I mean, that was like just a murderer's row of movies I just listed off. And this is like a small sliver of the movies that they've done, which is kind of perfect because this person's name is Joseph P. Reidy, R-E-I-D-Y. Never heard of this person, but like literally every one of their movies on their IMDb are just like A movies or like blockbusters or just top tier movies in general. These are the kind of people I'm looking for, is like, who's heard of Joseph P. Reidy? I have now, but haven't before. And then just the look at their IMDb is pretty damn impressive.
Joseph Bridges, I love you, man. I love also your choices of what are those choices. What are the movies that he actually recommended? The Hip Hop Witch a couple of weeks ago, he also recommended, which Eric, unfortunately, and a bunch of other people in our Cinemax Facebook group had to endure. Jack Fitzpatrick as well. I don't think Jack was a big fan of it. Eric, you wanted to say something about Joseph Bridges and The Hip Hop Witch?
I was going to confirm that Joseph P. Reidy did not produce The Hip Hop Witch. That is not listed on their IMDb at the very least.
Okay, well, I guess, Bruce, you didn't let me and Bruce guess for this Famously Anonymous because you automatically assumed we would not know the name of Joseph R. or P. Reidy.
Yeah, P.
A lot of, Joseph P. Reidy, R-E-I-D-Y, I believe. Yeah, these producers, I don't know. Bruce, can you name one or two producers? And I think we should learn more about producers. Let's see. Daryl Zanuck?
No, I mean,
Lily Zanuck?
Like, I mean, yeah, producers, usually the ones I can name are going to be people who are like also Robert directors Evans. Or something. Yeah. You probably just mentioned some that I would be like,
Did Busby Berkeley produce one of his dancing
movies? D.W. Griffith? Did he ever produce stuff? I don't know.
Let's see. Eisenstein? Did he produce some of his? Anyways, that's an interesting thing, Joseph Bridges. Directed Rush.
Love that movie. Yeah, I think that's the only movie, unless she directed one recently. I think
Wind.
That's her.
She also did Wind. Oh, no, she didn't do Wind. Oh, that was someone else who did
Harvey
Wind.
Weinstein. There you go.
No.
Right. I named one for you.
Okay, so that was this installment of Famously Anonymous. This was a producer credit, actually, producer and, like you said, assistant director, Joseph P. Reidy. Let's see what Eric can come up with down the road. Maybe Bruce and I will actually have some Famously Anonymous stuff for next week. Speaking of next week, we're going to be doing our Patreon 1986. It's the Bruce Perky Show for next week. Bruce Perky, movie choices for next week. What are all three of us going to cram for that bonus episode for our Patreon members?
Well, I will remind you all of the nominees, because this did get posted as a poll. The nominees were Sid and Nancy, Night of the Creeps, Armor of God, Something Wild, The Mosquito Coast, and Maximum Overdrive. Mm-hmm. And I'll start from the bottom up. 0%, Armor of God.
Okay.
sorry, Armor of God, you didn't get anything. Two came in at, let's see. Three tied with 13%, Maximum Overdrive, Mosquito Coast, and Something Wild. Mm-hmm. Number two, Sid and Nancy.
Okay.
Number one, Night of the Creeps.
All right. Sid and Nancy, Night of the Creeps will be our films we are spotlighting next week for the 1986 spotlight for our Patreon bonus episode. I have not seen Night of the Creeps. Sid and Nancy, is that based on a true story, Bruce? Would you know?
I mean, were the Sex Pistols a real group? I don't know. Kind of a question right there.
Rimshot. Okay. That's
so real quick, what's the other movie we're doing? Night of the Creeps and
Sid and Nancy.
Oh, okay.
Directed by Eric Holmes. Famously Anonymous, Eric Holmes. Here we go. I gotcha. Stump the band.
The repo man guy. Oh, Alex. Alex. Damn it.
Rhymes with Knox.
Cox. Alex Cox. Right.
You have to say G-rated. I'll say the opposite of wieners. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Several weeks.
Alex ago. Vagina.
Dang it. I confused myself. I don't know what's going
several
on.
Several weeks ago, Bruce, Eric, and I reviewed a Michael Keaton movie called Knox Goes Away. Bruce and I are directing and starring in a new movie about 50-something men who've lost their virility called Cox Goes Away. So, bump. Knox, Cox. Anyway, so... And, well, by the way, I like Knox Goes Away, and Bruce, you were kind of mixed on that. I think, Eric, do you remember Liking Knox Goes Away as well?
I didn't watch that one.
Oh, you didn't watch that? Oh.
Yeah.
Okay, that's very interesting. Okay. Now, Patreon, Night of the Creeps. It's like, I should have a picture of me right next to Night of the Creeps. Wait, Bruce, you've seen Night of the Creeps already when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah. Night of the Creeps is fantastic.
Fantastic. Okay,
I'm excited. I believe it's Fred Decker? I think that might be a Fred Decker joint.
Monster Squad, right? Yes.
Yeah, I could be wrong about that.
Night of the Creeps? Night of the Creeps? Have you seen it?
Yeah, I think that was one of the Splatterhouse movies. It's been a long time. So, yeah. Is that... Wait, maybe I'm thinking of...
Monster Squad.
Hmm? No, I think I'm thinking of the phenomena with the bugs.
Okay.
Oh. It's not bugs, but it rhymes with bugs. It's not kind of. And also, I think...
Oh, slugs?
Is this a rhyming show?
Okay. I think I did see that one then.
Okay.
And all I think the poster is something like, you know, blah, blah, blah. Your date is here, but your date's dead or some version of something like that. So.
All right. So it should be an interesting stuff. Alex Cox, again, Sid and Nancy. It's amazing. Eric Holmes mentioned Repo Man, his most underrated film, in my opinion. I think in our opinion, is Highway Patrolman. It is a movie that I think, yes, Eric, all of us love that movie. I have the Kino Lorber Blu-ray in the other room. Love this film so much. It's so amazing. I don't know, Bruce, if you agree with me on this. Alex Cox, how is his name not after? I mean, I know Walker didn't do well when it came out with Ed Harris, but you just mentioned three classic movies. Are you kind of surprised that he hasn't been making these type of movies like since then? I mean, or was he just too off the beaten path?
Had a cameo in Mad God.
Yeah, Mad God. I think he's just too much of a, I mean, he kind of has that punk rock ethic in that he's just making these weirdo movies and doing his own thing. I think he kind of got, if I remember when we talked about that, he kind of got re-noticed by mom and pop, not America, mom and pop Britain, because he used to post this kind of retrospective movie show and he'd put on like movies and talk about them beforehand, kind of like they do here in like Masterpiece Theater or something. So I think a lot of people got to know him then. But yeah, I think he's underloved, even though some of his movies are some of the favorite cult movies, especially the 80s. You know,
yeah.
A lot of people know his movies, at least.
According to IMDb, he's got a movie in development called Repo Man 2, The Wages of Beer.
Oh, that sounds very good. And plus, I still haven't seen Straight to Hell, and again, Walker. These are movies down the line. If we were still doing Find Your Film, we'd probably have spotlighted Alex Cox by now, but that's neither here nor there. Let's get to our features. First off, Dusk for a Hitman. We've all seen this movie. It's based on a true story, based on actually a real person, but the actual narrative itself is, a lot of it is fictionalized. So it's inspired by a real person. That real person is Donal Lavoie. Donal Lavoie is a hitman. And it's about his life as a hitman and how he tries to escape possible death or betrayal or tragedy within his family. He has a woman he loves. He wants to keep his family alive. But the thing is, Donal Lavoie, I just said he's a hitman. He ruthlessly kills people. That is his job. The trick for enjoying, quote, or getting on board with Dusk for Hitman is, are you going to follow a cold-blooded killer and root for him escaping the law, or actually by the end of this story, escaping death? How can you watch a movie about this pretty much evil human being? The movie is directed by Raymond St-Jean, written by St-Jean and Martine Gerard, and the lead actor, Eric Bruneau, fantastic as Donal Lavoie, really enjoyed this movie. I think for me, what turned the page was thinking of those Jimmy Cagney movies back in the 30s and 40s, movies like Public Enemy, where the main character, or something like Arthur Penn's Bonnie and Clyde, you get into the mind, not specifically in the mind, you actually follow a criminal through their escapades. And I think the prohibitive thing is, if you don't want to see a pretty evil human being for close to 2 hours, possibly skip Dusk for a Hitman. But I thought overall it had some really great ingredients. Let's start with Bruce Perkey on your thoughts on Dusk for a Hitman.
Yeah, I thought it had some great ingredients too. I liked it a lot more at the beginning than I did by the end. And partly it starts out, and I would say the first, 30, 40 minutes is really just him at work. Like, you're in his world, right? You're seeing him go on hits. You're seeing him deal with the local crime dude. Was it Claude Dubois? Yeah. So you're kind of getting the feel of like, what's this underworld like and what's the ins and outs of it and what is his kind of personality within that? In fact, I think I mentioned really early on, it's not a good job if you get to be this hitman's buddy, like his partner. It's not a very safe position to be in. You better be really good at your job because he's good at his job and he doesn't suffer people who are not like up to his standard.
His younger brother.
His younger brother is definitely a complication because his younger brother is kind of like the classic, kind of like the loser, like mess up younger brother that's always coming to him and always got a scam going or an angle going. And he's just not the reliable source of crime that his older brother is. And I think I really dug the kind of gritty, like throwback. It's what is the 70s, right? It takes place in the 70s.
Yeah.
Throwback.
Has that feel to it. Yeah.
Day to day, like what's going on? You're just following it. Almost not quite Goodfellas. It doesn't have that kind of like style and epicness to it, but still kind of that idea of like you're falling into this world you maybe know nothing about or hardly anything about. And I really dug that part. I would say as it went along, I kind of started to lose the thread. I kind of started to lose like, where are we going now? Like where is this going to lead to? I feel like it at some point it was beholden to the facts more than it was to a narrative. And I feel like I almost would have wished it had strayed more from the facts and just used this as maybe a inspiration for the movie and then let the movie be totally, you know, very fictional if it needed to be, and had to be a little more compelling that way. There were certain things that I thought they set up that I thought were for sure going to pay off. There's a scene where one character shows another character where a bunch of money is hidden. And I thought, well, for sure, that's going to come into play later. So there are a lot of pieces that are put up there that kind of I expected them to go somewhere, and they kind of went somewhere, but they kind of didn't fully satisfy me by the end.
Eric.
Oh, yeah, this is a really good Hitman movie. In fact, it's called Dust for a Hitman. I think kind of the point where Bruce kind of fell off is also kind of where Donald LaVoy is kind of falling off as well, kind of circling the drain, so to speak. One of the things I liked with the character is how ruthless he was. Because typically in movies like this, it's like, all right, you know, I'll show up with the gun pointing at you, Greg. And you're like, Eric, no, I got a family. I got blah, blah. And you start pleading for your life. There's almost none of that here because they don't have time. He just like once he's dead, you're gone.
You're gone.
And so there's a lot of spots, especially early on when he's doing his hitmaning, that people are just, he just takes them out like without any sort of warning. Like, because you've seen movies like this before. And so there's a certain cadence or pacing you're used to seeing with something like this. But with him, he just, gun comes out, they're dead. I was like, whoa, okay. I wasn't expecting that to happen so abruptly.
It's pretty violent. I was surprised at how violent it was. Not unrelenting, but it just shows the violence as is.
It just kind of comes out of nowhere. It's like you could kind of see it like in any other movie. It's like, oh, that person's dead. But usually you have a couple minutes to process that and then they end up dead like later on in the movie. This one, as soon as you get an inkling of, oh, that person's bang. Oh, okay. He took care of it pretty quick. And then, but yeah, this is a really good Hitman movie.
I also like Eric Bruneau's performance as Donald LaVoy. He does this whole Steve McQueen, Alain Delon, cooler than the room vibe, which I think Bruce was actually talking about maybe the first half. You get to really build that character and that mood and the atmosphere. And talking about the second half, it sort of tails off a little bit. I really liked it all throughout, but I can see how maybe Bruce might have thought the first half of Dusk for Hitman, as far as its world building, was more interesting. Eric, did you, without giving too much away, were you okay with the third act of the way it ended? As far as not okay, okay,
yeah, good. I loved it for obvious reasons.
Okay, loved it for obvious.
Well, we'll just leave it at that.
And Bruce, what do you think about the whole thing about this is an unrepentant killer? Do you think some people, was I being a little bit too overshooting as far as some people might not like it because it's a very unlikable person? I know that's such a cliche to throw out there.
I don't know. I think people who are into a crime, like a gritty throwback crime movie, I think you're kind of into that anyway. So I don't think that's going to hurt you. If you're looking for more of a crime and justice sort of movie, then this maybe would not go for you, for sure. I also did want to mention really quick, great Canadian movie. We don't get a lot of Canadian, especially Canadian crime movies. That's not very common. And great use of Nazareth in the soundtrack. I appreciate that too.
All right. Yeah, so some really good stuff. Nazareth is actually, and also there's a final song, which I had to look up on YouTube, that it's not very popular. It's really well done, and it's not in English, okay, but it's really a good, good song. And Celine Dion was actually doing, I saw a YouTube version with Celine Dion and the people for that track. I forgot the name of the song, but it's an amazing song. But anyways, Dust for a Hitman, it's in, no, not in theaters, it's on digital and on demand April 19th. I feel, if, again, Bruce was mentioning crime thrillers, if you are looking for an under-the-radar crime thriller, I thought this was first rate. Right down the middle, really good performances. I disagree with Bruce a little bit. I liked it a little bit more. I liked it a little bit more. I don't know, maybe a little bit less than Eric. I don't know what Eric's rating is going to be. But mine is right down the middle with a four-star rating for me. Just worth a look. I was surprised by Eric Bruneau. I loved his performance. That is a well-done film. Bruce.
I am just a tiny bit below you. I'm 3.5, but I still say it's pretty solid. And especially if you are seeing those covers and you think like, oh, it's just one of those weird cheapo indie cut crime, you know, cookie cutter crime thrillers. Mm-hmm. This is a cut above that. This has got some care to it for sure.
Definitely. Eric Holmes.
I'm kind of right down the middle between 3.5 and 4, but since we don't have a 3.75, I'll just be generous and call 4 because it was a good one.
Yeah, this is sort of one of those under the radar things that we like to cover in cinematics. It's not going to be one of the main releases in cinemas because it's not going to be a release in cinemas. And whatever digital platform you use, you might be scrolling past it, but I'll give it a pretty good review. Maybe give Dusk for a Hitman a shot. Next up. Can we end the show now? Is The Coffee Table? No, that's not something that Bruce and Eric has in their respective domiciles. This is a movie, and I don't know what else to say about it.
Amicita del Comedor.
Okay.
Because if you look up The Coffee Table, you're going to get a TV series. But if you look up La Mesita del Comedor, you'll get this.
La Mesita del Comedor. Do you want?
Hey, well, can I suggest something?
Yeah, no.
How about we just talk about it?
Okay.
And then if we go too far, you'll just have to cut some stuff out. So anyone listening to this, if it like cuts out and comes back, you'll know that we probably said too much.
Very good, Eric. Yes. If you hear some kind of horrible edit like Greg Srizavasti usually does on a weekly basis, it will be because this non sequitur, we went too far. In the story of Jesus and Maria. Jesus and Maria, they're the main characters? Jesus and Maria, they are a bickering couple. You can tell they are sort of at wit's end with each other, exemplified by their recent sort of visit to maybe a furniture store or something like this, because they are arguing over a coffee table. And it looks like a very gaudy coffee table. It's a glass table with these two fake gold sculptures of... Are the women naked?
Two naked women, like connected at the feet or something like that.
Yeah, and they're the placeholders for that coffee table, and the glass itself is impenetrable. It's very strong. That's what the oily, slimy salesman says about the coffee table, is that it's indestructible. It'll make your life happy. Everything will be great. There's a whole monologue he does about how awesome the table is. And Maria is just going back and forth with the salesman, telling him he's a ton of BS. He's dishing out a ton of BS. Catch is, though, I don't really know if Jesus really likes the coffee table, but this is his last stand as a man against Maria, because they're new parents, beautiful baby boy. I believe baby boy? Yeah, baby boy. And Jesus wants to have one final say. He wants a little piece of him in their respective apartment. Okay? So he is adamant about buying this coffee table. Eventually, Maria relents. They bring the coffee table back to their domicile, and the movie centers on Jesus, Maria, their baby. They're going to have actually Jesus's brother and 18-year-old girlfriend over for dinner. Should be a really nice, happy thing. But the problem is Jesus and Maria are arguing back and forth. You can tell they're really frustrated with each other. There's a lot of banter back and forth. The catch is the coffee table is not exactly the best coffee table in the world. Something very tragic happens. We're not going to mention specifically what happens, but the rest of the narrative deals with how Jesus is dealing with this situation with the coffee table, and how is he going to deal with it with Maria, his brother, the girlfriend, and also this young 13-year-old neighbor who claims that Jesus has been actually in love with her. And that's a sort of another subplot behind the coffee table. It is a very interesting movie, to say the least. Let's start off with Eric Holmes and your reaction to the coffee table.
So this definitely is kind of not the same, but in a similar ballpark of Force Majeure, where Force Majeure is a thing, the inciting incident happened and everyone witnessed it, and it's the fallout of them dealing with that. This one's a little different because the inciting incident happens. He needs to tell someone about it, but is trying to figure out how to do it. And the longer he waits to do that, the more difficult it is to mention it. Because, like you said, they got people coming over, like all this other stuff piles on top of that. So it's kind of, you just see him basically stewing in what he's done, and he just wants to let it out. And I think this movie's kind of sold as a dark comedy. Yeah. And the I guess we'll kind of leave it there. There's another story I kind of really want to compare this to, but that might be a little too much. Yeah, this is basically right at, and it's weird that we're like trying not to spoil what happens, because it's the thing that happens like within the first 5-10 minutes. The thing that sets off the rest of the story, right? But
yeah,
but when you watch it, you'll know why we're dancing around it. Yeah, it's basically the thing happens, and then we know what happens. The guy knows what happens because he did it. No one else does. So basically, we just get to watch him squirm for the rest of the movie and just kind of deal with the repercussions of that, and you know, just kind of internalize, how the hell am I going to say this now? I can't hide it, but I can't tell him. And like, you just see him tortured like throughout the entire thing.
Movie's directed by Kaye Casas, written by Casas and Cristina Borobia. And like Eric says, the Spanish name is La Mesita del Comedor. La Mesita del Comedor was suggested from Bruce Berkey. He wanted us to actually review it this week. This is one of the movies he wanted to actually review.
Oh, so it's Bruce's fault.
It might be Bruce's fault. It might be his fault, or it might be a blessing. It's very interesting. I'm glad that Bruce Berkey and Eric suggest films for us to watch on a given week, because to be honest, I miss so much stuff. And who knows? Bruce, The Coffee Table, were you glad? Was this a missable movie, or are you glad that you recommended this movie for us to watch?
I mean, I'm glad that I watched it. I'm glad we recommended to watch it. I think it's interesting to see. This is a very hard recommend. Like, you have to know very well who you're recommending this movie to, because this is definitely one of those you just recommend this willy-nilly kind of movies that people will hate you for that. People will say, like, what kind of a terrible person are you? It's funny because you mentioned Force Majeure. I kept thinking of A Christmas Story. Like, it starts out and it's the leg lamp. Basically, this table is the leg lamp.
I was thinking A Christmas Carol. I'm like,
So if you take that leg lamp and instead it's this coffee table, and then the husband, you know, wins and gets to bring it home, and he loves his leg lamp, the coffee table. But then it becomes, the whole story ends up becoming, like Eric says, it becomes the bomb under the table of you get a Hitchcock, where now you know. In this case, it's a little different because the main character knows too, but none of the other characters know. And the difference also is this bomb is going to go off. You cannot stop this bomb from going off, and you cannot stop it from hitting other people. What do you do? This is also, I would think, and I was wondering what Eric thought about this. This is almost like a writer's exercise. Like, yes. You write a situation and you have to follow it through. Like, you cannot get a deus ex machina. There's no outs. You have to follow it through, and you have to have it go somewhere that it would have to go. Now, the characters and stuff that come into it, sure, those are all random. You could not have that happen. But the ultimate thing that's going to happen has to happen before the end of this story. Like, the knowledge has to be, I guess, discovered, is all I will say. So I guess I respect this movie more than I enjoyed it, but I also kind of liked some of it a lot, and I kind of hated some of it a lot. I'm really, really torn on this. This is one I'm really torn on. I will say, and I don't want to even mention what the poster is. There's a poster of a famous movie character and a famous scene from a famous movie on the wall in one of the rooms in this, which is an incredible cruel joke based on what this movie's about. And if you guys didn't notice it, I'm not going to mention it here.
Oh, wow.
I will just say,
I think, oh, Okay.
There's a poster of, if you have video now, you're getting spoiled. There's a poster of this.
All right.
With somebody. A very infamous scene from that movie.
Oh, very interesting. Oh, very, very interesting. So yeah, the coffee table. I messaged Bruce while watching it and I said, this is a totally, I didn't even say uncomfortable. I said, this is a very uncomfy experience for me. I was frustrated with this movie. This is when you're in the sort, when you're in the confines of the main character of, and what he's supposed, what he's going through every single second, you're just tense and you're not supposed to enjoy this movie. Bruce was talking about enjoyable movie. This is, I know what you were saying, Bruce, but this is just a torturous experience to watch. And I think that's a compliment to director Kaiji Casas, because with a limited budget, the visuals are pretty flat, right? But I think that's, you don't really, that's sort of the fits the genre, because this is a tragic situation. You want pretty things to be pretty spare. There's definitely different angles and cuts to make this more alluring visually. But overall, this is just a closed in, frustrating experience that there are, I was very frustrated by the end of the movie. I thought the third act was well done. And I think I was going to pan this movie initially, but ultimately my final judgment on this is I'm never going to watch this movie again.
Yeah.
Okay. But this is cinema. So I think as far as, look, are we going to watch 120 Days of Sodom again? I don't think so. I don't think, the first time I saw it, I thought it was enough. I'm glad I was able to see it. As far as film knowledge and history, this is one of the most uncomfortable films I've seen. And I think just based on those merits, also the actual what happens with the coffee table and the tension that's being built in this narrative, I believe this is worth a watch one time. As far as expand, and who knows, you might even like it more than me. Maybe Bruce and Eric like it more than me. So for me, The Coffee Table, mild recommendation, 3 stars. Eric Holmes.
Well, first of all, the third act in this, just when you thought it couldn't get worse.
Right, of course. Yes, yes, yes.
This movie, oddly enough, I'd actually do want to watch this again just to watch kind of you know, I can do it without the beginning and without the end, as great as they are, like within the context of this movie. But I really want to watch it again with the watch the conversations, because, you know, when they're talking about the broken leg lamp and I'm so excited to see the broken leg lamp. Where is it at? We don't have to worry about the broken leg. The conversations that they had when they're talking about the thing, not knowing that they're talking about the thing, is just too great to pass up. And I kind of want to watch it again just to see, like, see if there's any more kind of hidden sort of jabs. I didn't catch the thing Bruce was talking about, and I still don't know that I completely get it, but you can tell me later.
We might do a small spoiler section anyway, we thought about. If we do, I'll mention it there.
I mean, we kind of have to. Yeah. Okay. But yeah, this movie's not easy. Definitely not a recommend for everyone, but for what it's trying to get across, nails it. So I got to go 5 stars on this.
5 stars on The Coffee Table from Eric Holmes. What a praiseworthy review. 3 stars from me. Bruce, wow.
I can't go 5 stars. I think I'm going to go 3-star banger on this movie. I think people who are into the vibe of this are going to love it. And I think people who like really push to the edge sort of transgressive movies will actually really enjoy this movie. I think it's going to find a very strong cult audience. So I'm going to give it 3-star banger for that reason.
Okay, good, good. Bruce Berkey with the 3-star banger, 5 stars from Eric Holmes.
Hopefully Greg didn't have to cut too much of that out.
No. Zero.
I think we did pretty good on that. I think it's enough to entice people, like, what are they talking about? Like, what is, but just be warned.
Right. Be warned.
This is the kind of movie that will mess you up.
Yes. It will possibly mess you up. Bruce was saying about viewers who want likes transgressive cinema. Eric, you gave it 5 stars, highest rating among all three of us.
Oh, second what's highest. 6.9 is the highest.
All right, that's true. But what is the, right, exactly. What is your warning for people? So 5 stars, but the caveat is for people who should not watch this, essentially.
It'd be a spoiler to say.
Oh, it'd be a spoiler to
Angie
say.
Clark should not watch
Angie
this.
Clark, do not. Angie Clark can skip this one.
Right. So, yeah. Okay.
Andrew Clark, hit me up and I'll tell you exactly why you should skip this one. I will spoil the crap out of it for you. Thank me later.
I am totally... Bruce, you and I are safe. I am going to lead this week for our social media stuff. Eric Holmes loves the coffee table. We'll get all the people. Everyone go see La Mesita del Comedor. So we'll see. But, okay. So that's that for that. Okay. So Blood for Dust. Wait. Another crime thriller? We just did a crime thriller with Dust for Hitman. Blood for Dust isn't as good as Dust for Hitman. Here's the catch, though. Scoot McNairy, an actor I think is fantastic. I don't know how you feel, Eric. You've interviewed Scoot McNairy. Yeah. You're a fan? Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
I love him. I've seen half of Halt and Catch Fire. That's a TV series he was in years back on AMC. Thought he was great in that. He's also great in that movie Killing Me Softly. Is that the one with Brad Pitt? He's just a great actor. He was in Narcos, I think Mexico, one of those series which I have not seen. Just a wonderful actor. He is the lead for Blood for Dust, movie set somewhere in the early 90s. He is not an insurance salesman. He is a salesman who has a pretty checkered past. Let's just say that. And he's trying to make ends meet, trying to pay the mortgage for his house and his wife. You see a little bit of his wife because he's on the road a lot. She's left at home alone. She has faith in her husband that he's going to bring the money back to the family and support her and support the house and support the overall family. But again, Cliff, played by Scoot McNairy, he feels like his salesman job, I think he's selling defibrillators, right? And he's not doing a really good job and he needs to make ends meet. So what happens is he hooks up with an old colleague named Ricky. Ricky is played by Kit Harington, best known as Jon Snow from Game of Thrones. Ricky is a friend, but the thing is, Ricky is not exactly the kind of friend you want to call when you're in trouble, because Ricky promises Cliff a whole bunch of money, maybe deals with drugs and money, and bottom line is Cliff needs the cash, so Cliff decides to go in cahoots with Ricky on some kind of cash for drugs for cash kind of deal. This deal, as with every single movie about these type of things, they go south, and then Ricky and Cliff have to figure out what to do in the aftermath. So I was reading some reviews. It says it's sort of a Breaking Bad meets Fargo. It's also co-stars Stephen Dorff in a very short role, but he was very good. We love Stephen Dorff. Josh Lucas as one of the crime boss, the low-level crime boss in this film. Some interesting visuals, very interesting performances. Blood for Dust. Eric Holmes, your review.
Yeah. The only real knock I have against this is Stephen Dorff is in one scene.
Sure.
And that's not a knock because he's in one scene. It's a knock because he's not in more than one scene, just to be clear. I love Stephen Dorff. I would love to see him more. But I mean, with his character is kind of a one and done character anyway, so it wouldn't make sense to keep having him.
We forgot to mention, sorry, Eric, Ethan Suplee from My Name is Earl.
I was also just about to get there.
Sorry, go ahead.
Ethan Suplee is fantastic in this. Like, you know, used to seeing him as the comic relief in movies. I was scared crapless. Like, he is so intimidating in this. I'm like, oh, what the hell is a guy from Mallrats about to do? Like, he's about to kill someone. He's about to kill me. Kit Harington, I know he was in the Eternals. I never watched Game of Thrones, really. Yes. So I'm not that, like, I know who Kit Harington is. I haven't seen a bunch of stuff with him. He was great in this. Okay. Scoot McNairy's basically a lot of it's just Scoot McNairy and Kit Harington kind of together, except for when Scoot McNairy and Ethan Suplee are together. But I love the back and forth between Scoot and Kit. Yeah, all the actors in this are great. It's a really cool crime thriller. Almost.
Does it drop off, Eric? How's the pacing?
I love the pacing. The pacing was kind of similar to like Out of the Furnace, like one of those kind of movies.
Landscapes are good. I love the landscapes. It captures a part of Americana that I thought was good visually. I thought it was good. Yeah. Lonely open roads. So motels. But,
I loved all that. It was kind of a heist movie, sort of. So I think you mentioned Fargo, like the landscape's way different than Fargo, but it'd probably be like Fargo during the summertime. It's kind of what it looked like. It's kind of a similar vibe to that. And yeah, this one, I wasn't quite sure what to expect from it, but I like this one a lot. I saw this shortly after Dust for a Hitman. And I think they make a great double feature because they're both really similar in a lot of ways. In fact, when we were talking about Dust for a Hitman, I'm like, that was Blood for Dust. And now I'm thinking of Blood for Dust. I'm like, I really like that part where, that was Dust for a Hitman. So they're not the same movie, but they marry well together, I think.
Also, I think this movie captures Cliff's desperation really well because we don't want to give away about his checkered past, but I think it really delves into why Cliff is maybe a failed salesman, possibly a failed husband. Actually, one of the tensest moments in this movie deals when a colleague actually asks Cliff, hey, don't I know you from somewhere? And Cliff is trying to actually say, no, you don't know me. You know, we're a salesman. Our faces are, we're a dime a dozen. I said, no, I kind of remember you from somewhere. That's what's interesting. That's not even a crime moment, but that was a very tense moment in Blood for Dust. There's a couple of really interesting action sequences. One regard in a what Eric is sort of in a farm barn area, which I think is really well done with animals. You see it in the trailer. It's a really good moment. We're not going to say who it involved because that will be a spoiler. Blood for Dust for me, I was going to go 3.5, but I liked the way it ended. I liked a lot of moments in Blood for Dust. Again, I agree with Eric. My only complaint was Stephen Dorff, put him in more scenes, please. I understand within the fabric of the narrative why it's only one scene, but wish we had more of him. But for me, Blood for Dust, yes, Eric Holmes, how dare you? How dare you? You put 4 stars on the Google Doc knowing that I would give it 4 stars. Very good, Eric Holmes. What is your rating?
How can Eric do that, right?
He's just...
I'm kind of with you on 4 stars, but Kit Harington was so good. Ethan Suplee just knocked me out. He was knocked my socks off.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to go 4.5 on this one.
4.5 from Eric Holmes.
Yeah. Very good. I think I liked Scoot McNairy just kind of carrying the film. Everyone was so damn good in this. And it was just a really good crime thriller. And if you get a chance, we talked about Dust for a Hitman. Watch Blood for Dust and then go to Dust for a Hitman or vice versa. Either way, both these make for a great double feature. And they're both coming out around the same time. So why not?
Eric, you forgot to mention the second complaint of Blood for Dust. Number one is Stephen Dorff. Lack thereof. Number two, what was it, Eric? What's the next big complaint?
I don't know.
Okay.
More Ethan Suplee would have been good too.
Okay, that might be okay. My number two nomination for my second biggest complaint: no coffee table for Blood for Dust.
That's not a complaint. I know.
Anyways, 4.5 stars from Eric Holmes, 4 stars for me. Blood for Dust. It's in theaters and on digital, April 19th. Bruce and I will go little Betty Bye for the next several minutes because there is a documentary that Eric Holmes did. Its documentary is called Photographic Justice, I believe. It opens April 19th in New York, April 26th in Los Angeles. Eric Holmes, the floor is yours. I will shut my pie hole.
All right. Well, this Photographic Justice, the Corky Lee story, basically just follows Corky Lee. It's a biography on Corky Lee. He was a photographer, and he would take pictures of a bunch of Asian Americans at different like rallies or different political turmoil stuff that goes on, and he would just kind of start taking pictures. Like they had one part where kind of one of the earlier pictures he took was this Asian American just getting the crap kicked out of him by cops. Other photojournalists were there taking pictures of the event, and they said, this, and this happened. And it's like, that's not how it went down. I'm like, well, what proof do you have? And it's like, oh, this guy Corky took this picture. And they're like, oh yeah, we didn't see any of that going on. And so he's kind of positioned himself as a photojournalist, and a really good one, mostly centering on Asian Americans. And it just kind of goes through his life. And he kind of has not only does he take pictures for journalistic integrity, but he has kind of an artistic mind too, because like he would set up these shows, these art shows of his photography. And, he has like a whole vault, a literal vault of like all his pictures he's ever taken. And so he would like pull those out, go, okay, I remember this event, we took this, but this event transpires to this event, so we'll put these pictures. So like his whole art setup is all the pictures, but they tell a story within themselves. And on top of all that, they would interview people that knew Corky, and he was just a great guy. like, you know, just fun loving, like really warm person. Even the director, Jennifer Takaki, knew him. And when I interviewed her, she had nothing but nice things to say about Corky. And so it's basically just following this guy's life. And you can cut this out if you need to. Unfortunately, Corky Lee is no longer with us. So a lot of people are kind of sad that he's gone. But I didn't know who he was. But I know apparently after watching this documentary, a lot of people do. So I think this would kind of be similar to that Gene Wilder doc that we saw. Where sure. I think there's a bunch of people that knew Corky Lee either through his work or people that knew him personally, that this would be like a nice kind of memory of him. You know, like, hey, let's go back and visit Corky for a bit.
How about someone like me and Bruce who are not don't know anything about Corky Lee? Is it to the mass? Is it worth a look?
I think so, because okay. I knew nothing about him going in, and just finding out what he did and kind of how he mixes the art with the photojournalism stuff was really interesting. And this movie bookends, it's not a total booking because there's something that comes a little after that, but it bookends real nicely because they had so at the beginning of the movie, they show a picture of, you know, they mentioned that the Chinese built the railroads. And then when they met the railroads together and put the golden spike down, they have this picture of all these people posing next to the railroad tracks and the train. And Corky Lee's like, you know, going with a magnifying glass, looking at everyone there and not one Chinese person there. So one of the things he puts together is to recreate that same shot on that same spot, but have a bunch of the, what do you call it? Not the
representation or descendants?
Descendants of the people that worked on the railroads there instead of the white men that did nothing, but, you know, took the photo op. Okay. So it's kind of the exact opposite of what the picture was.
Well, interesting.
And just like stuff like that is, yeah, it's good stuff. Check it out.
Well, unfortunately, Eric Holmes, I'm going to cut this review of Photographic Justice because as an Asian American, it's very embarrassing that you know more about Asian American history than me. So I was going to cut it.
I don't. I only know this because I saw the documentary.
I know. Well, then I have to educate myself. Me and Bruce Perky will have to educate ourselves. I give Bruce the long leash. I give myself a short leash because me being part Thai and part Filipino, how dare I not give Photographic Justice a try?
Eric.
Yes, Bruce.
Or you can have Eric in the clear just say, Greg said, and then you can have him just put that in between everything he says. Greg said,
let me give you a clean soundbite for that. Greg said, Greg said, Greg said,
there you go. Good. Very good, folks. If I'm going to try to edit it, if you're hearing the real cut, then I apologize. I am too lazy. I am not as ambitious and visionary as Chinese American photographer Corky Lee. The subject of Photographic Justice again opens April 19th in New York. I will find out where it's opening in New York and I'll put that link in our show notes. April 26th, the following week in Los Angeles. Eric Holmes, his interview with Jennifer Takaki will be available on our Cinematics YouTube channel this week and then also will be in a future podcast feed for Cinematics. Photographic Justice. Eric Holmes, your rating?
I'd give this 4 stars pretty easily. And I think for people that know Corky Lee, it might go even higher than that. I think the only people that don't like this, if you hate photojournalism, this is not the documentary for you. Or you're like just sitting at home, stupid photojournalists, I hate them all. Like, then skip it. Otherwise, I think it's a pretty good one.
Right. Again, Bruce and I, we're going to continue to cut your reviews this week because Bruce and I, I'm speaking for Bruce, we are uneducated cinephiles. How dare you, Eric Holmes, to throw another documentary into the mix, lest it be an HBO documentary, An American Bombing, The Road to April 19th. Your interview with the director, Mark Levin, is currently housed on our Cinematics YouTube channel. Eric Holmes, take it away. Currently now, streaming on Max, should people like me and Bruce, documentary fans, should we watch this doc and why?
So this one is An American Bombing, The Road to April 19th, basically centers around the Oklahoma City bombing. And it's kind of stuff, if you're familiar at all with the Oklahoma City bombing early on, it's not a lot of new information. But then they delve deeper into why Timothy McVeigh did that, and forget the other a-hole's name that was involved. And so when they kind of stop at the Oklahoma City bombing and go back, now we're getting into territory that at least I wasn't aware of. And I guess a lot of it came from his thoughts on David Koresh. They delve pretty deep into that.
Ruby Ridge, probably. Ruby Ridge.
I don't know.
Okay, I'll take it back. I know David Koresh and Ruby Ridge were like the big things that got a lot of that militia stuff going.
Yeah, it's mentioned in the press release.
All right, so there you go. There's something I don't know about that Greg does.
No, it's not nothing against you, Eric. I'm just reading. I just read straight from the press release. It says of the farm crisis, the Gulf War, Ruby Ridge, and Waco, as far as influences. So, yeah, go ahead, Eric. Sorry.
Well, anyway, they go into David Koresh and why he did what he did, leading up to why Timothy McVeigh did what he did, leading up to the Oklahoma City bombing. And then they get like I think this is kind of more of a retrospective, because they interview a lot of people kind of involved. But like today, like, so it's, I don't know what, 30 years later or however long ago it was. And so they're interviewing a bunch of people today, kind of looking back on it. There was one interview, and I mentioned this in the interview with Mark Levin. There was one interview in particular that almost made me throw up in my mouth. A guy was talking about, there's a bunch of gay people. I think they were like housing a church or something. The idea was to go and destroy them, whether it beat them up or I think they were going to bomb the church or set fire to it or do something horrible. They were going to kind of stake it out. And if I recall correctly, the guy was talking about going to stake it out. It's like, hey, I went in there and I saw all their hands up in the air. And, you know, I just saw a bunch of Christians. I didn't see gay people. I saw a bunch of Christians. And I'm like, I cannot kill God's children like this. And it was kind of meant like an aw shucks moment. Like I saw the light and I was like, you didn't want to not kill them because you realized it was the wrong thing to do. You wanted to not kill them because you realized they were Christian. And I was just like, so there's like a bunch of stuff like that. They interview Bill Clinton a lot in this. Bill Clinton kind of makes my skin crawl just in general. Yeah, I think people are going to have differing opinions on this based on their politics for sure. But I think just kind of as a documentary, like, just going in and saying, these are the things that happened. These are the things that led up. That is a really good one.
Okay.
Other than like, I think they kind of soft pedaled the Bill Clinton stuff. But other than that, I think it's pretty good documentary overall.
Directed by Mark Levin, An American Bombing, The Road to April 19th. Eric, what is your review? Your rating, sorry.
I think this will go 4.5. Because some of the interviews that they have and some of the stuff that they kind of point out that I didn't know about, that the way a lot of it triggered me, but like in a good way, like, you know, just getting me all fired up. If I was really tired and I needed to stay awake for another couple hours, I would put this on, get myself all angry, and then I would not be able to sleep for another 10 hours. So this is perfect for that kind of thing.
Okay, that is An American Bombing. The rating for Eric Holmes is 4.5 stars. Again, it is streaming right now on Max. I believe it's An American Bombing, The Road to April 19th, I believe. That's the full. Yes, thank you, Eric Holmes, for that. A lot of documentary stuff. Now, let's complete our episode this week, episode 238, with a What's in the Box review. From Bruce Perkey, welcome back, sir. What is the movie you are reviewing that I think most people have seen? Yes, I think Eric Holmes. Have you seen Cinema Party? So Eric Holmes, ever?
Yes, I did.
Okay, what is your thoughts? Why don't you hijack Bruce's segment right now? Your quick thoughts on Cinema?
Just real quick thoughts. I should have watched An American Bombing before starting Cinema Party. So.
Oh, did you? You didn't watch it again, did you? No, you didn't have time to watch it. Did you? Did you see it? You see it?
Yeah.
Did you watch it?
Yeah.
Oh. Wait, was that your first time watching Cinema Paradiso?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Okay, Bruce, lead it away. It's your segment.
So this is one of those. I think we all have these. I think pretty much every movie fan has these movies that are like beloved or classics, or everyone's talked about them forever and everyone just knows what they are, but you just never watched them, whether it's Casablanca, Christmas Story. Yeah, whatever. Pick this movie that is kind of legendary, I guess. And Cinema Paradiso is one of those movies from 1988. directed by Giuseppe Tornatore.
Giuseppe Tornatore. Yeah.
Thank you. I'll call him Toto. I wonder how that came up. So basic concept is, well, it starts out, Alfredo has died. And Alfredo was somebody that was very important to this guy, Salvatore, who goes Toto. So you immediately flash back to Toto as a young child, where he is obsessed with films and getting into the projection booth of the local cinema, Cinema Paradiso. Alfredo is the projectionist, and he at first is kind of trying to always kick out Toto. And of course, the whole idea is this is kind of this, the life of love of movies by Toto, and kind of the different ages it happens to him when he's a little kid, when he's a teenager, and then you kind of have him coming back after the death of Alfredo to the town to see what has happened as an older man now himself. There are some, and early on, the main thing you see very, very beginning is they will screen movies first for the local priest, and the priest sits there with a bell, and basically any time that there's something that's unacceptable to be seen by the public. Usually it's kissing or not really much nudity in those days, probably, but anything considered too risque. He would ring the bell and then get all upset, and they would mark the film where they need to edit it, and they would edit it out. And
clip it out.
Right out of they'd clip it out. They'd cut it out of the print. And
that was Alfredo's job. Alfredo had to clip it out.
Toto immediately wants to steal all those pieces, you know, and Alfredo's like, heck no, you don't do that. You know, no. And eventually Alfredo kind of warms up to Toto and lets him start actually learning about films and projection and all that stuff. So, I mean, that's the basic concept, is kind of the lifelong love of film and how it affects this, you know, young child. And I take place, oh, by the way, the young child version of the story takes place shortly after World War II. Toto's father has not come back from the war, which we can guess he's probably didn't make it back from the war. So he's kind of, you know, a fatherless. His mom is there, of course, but he's like a lot of young children after World War II. They kind of are, you know, running around and just getting into trouble and stuff. And they're a little bit adrift because half of their families have been lost a lot of times in those days. So he's finding a lot of his meaning and stuff from film.
And we also have to mention that Toto eventually grows up to be, not, you mentioned that when he's an adult, but then we also see a little bit of his coming of age in his teen years, when Toto is now called Salvatore, and Salvatore, he falls in love with this new girl who comes into town. Her name is Elena, and you get a little bit of a subplot in the middle of the movie regarding his first love as a teen. Also, Bruce mentioned the death of Alfredo at the beginning. So ultimately, this movie is one big flashback until it isn't, and then it comes to a crescendo with the final moments of Cinema Paradiso, with a not too subtle score from Ennio Morricone. Yeah. That score is slathered all over the movie. If you have some really great member berries or have a very sentimental attachment to the movie like I do, I can't get enough of the score. I've bought the CD maybe 5 or 6 times and lost it over the last, I don't know, 30 plus years. I love it, the score. Bruce, your thoughts on the score? Was it too much for you?
It was fitting for the movie. I mean, the movie overall is a little bit much for me, but go ahead. Oh, let's see what Eric has to say.
How dare you, Bruce? Yes. Eric, can you bring a little bit of, just a little bit of lightness and logic to Bruce's just horrific remark on, I take umbrage to that. What did you think of Cinema Paradiso?
This movie nailed Steven Spielberg's schmaltz for sure. has plenty of that in it. Uh-huh.
Wow.
I really like the early parts between Salvatore and Alfredo. Mm-hmm. And then once it got like, it was slow going, I wasn't really digging it. But then eventually I kind of warmed up to their relationship. Once he got to his teenage years and throughout the rest of the movie, I just started just checking out. I'm like,
you guys are talking about
the movie's done. Let's end this. Like,
really?
I think once, I don't know, what can we say and what can we not say about this as far as like spoilers? There's a thing that happens halfway through the movie.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that definitely do not mention that part. Yeah.
Okay. There's a thing that happens about halfway. So I don't know if you've seen Transformers, the movie. There's a part halfway through the movie, Starscream, yes. Something happens to Starscream, and that's the point where Transformers the movie starts taking a nosedive. There's that exact same part in Cinema Paradiso where once it hits that part, I don't care anymore.
96% Rotten Tomato score from people who are living and breathing, hopefully most of them, on Cinema Paradiso. You mentioned schmaltz, you mentioned a Transformers movie, and you a bit much. Bruce and Eric, who are these people? Are these co-hosts of Cinematics? Eric Holmes, keep it on. Yeah. Keep going. I want to hear it.
I like that. This kind of reminded me of like 400 Blows when I saw when I first saw it for the first time, where I was like,
all right, that's a classic film.
Why this? Like, why is everyone so falling over themselves over it? I hate 400 Blows.
You hate boring. 400 Blows. Boring.
Yeah. That 400 Blows. It was one blow. That movie blows.
It's Watch Your Foe. You blow on the 400 blows. That's amazing. Eric and Bruce, without giving too much away, the ending of the movie is supposed to be very emotional. Me, as an 18-year-old, I was teary. Eric and Bruce, tell me what your feelings towards the end of the movie. Were you just glad it ended?
I was trying very hard to stay awake by the end of the movie.
Honest review, Eric. I'm kidding.
That's why I said I wish I watched An American Bombing before Cinema Paradiso, because then I would have just been wide awake through the whole thing. Granted, Eric, I wouldn't be paying attention to the movie. I'd be just raging inside my brain about what I saw about An American Bombing. But
I'm glad you said this. I'm glad you said this. You said it's boring.
Yes.
You were bored by it. Do you have any kind of inkling, and I mean this truthfully, why people like me or a lot of cinephiles fall head over heels for Cinema Paradiso? Bruce, I'll probably get to ask you the same question.
Probably the first half of it. And then I think for a lot of people, maybe it just they just carried it throughout the rest of the movie. I can totally see that. It's just once, I can't even talk about it. Once you get about to the halfway point, for me, the movie was done. And it never reintroduced anything that I cared about.
Fair, Eric. Bruce, do you agree with what Eric Holmes is saying? Do you have an idea of why people like me? Is it just a sentimental attachment to it?
I mean, definitely a sentimental attachment. I think it's because of the nostalgia of a bygone era of communal experience in the movie theater and like the specialness of everybody like experiencing that same thing in the theater. But I mean, I was around in the late 60s, early 70s, seeing movies in theaters. And I mean, maybe that was they did in Italian cinema. They didn't do that kind of stuff in American cinemas. I mean, sure, there's much more of a communal experience and you had those grand cinemas. And I like that kind of stuff. But it was so schmaltzy. It was
so
sappy.
Did you roll your eyes at the final moments of Cinema Paradiso?
I'm honestly trying to remember what happened now.
That just breaks my heart.
I mean, I know what happened to the cinema, but I don't remember. Yeah. Oh, I remember now. I remember now. Oh, yeah. No, that was super sad. I saw that coming a million miles away. I was like, oh, yeah, I know what that's going to be. Yeah.
I'm going to just say this to cap the end of our show. Me as an 18-year-old at UCLA, okay, I'm going to mention my alma mater, UCLA. I'm a UCLA Bruin guy. I was at the local eatery near, I think it was North Campus. Was it South Campus? One of the campuses, the artistic side of the campus. So it was lunch and I was right next to this really beautiful girl. Okay. And I thought to myself, I had just seen Cinema Paradiso. I thought, wow, this girl is so beautiful. I need to say something to her. I was inspired by Cinema Paradiso. And we were holding our trays right next to each other. And I saw a mango and I just said, oh, by the way, you should get a mango. That's a really great fruit. Me being Filipino, I should know. And then she looked at me like really weird and she just, I think, laughed a little bit. I was trying to do my Woody Allen shtick with the whole funny, me trying to be funny Greg. Ultimately, we sat down and had lunch together for 30 minutes. I asked her what her favorite movie was and she said Cinema Paradiso. And I remember, to my horror, this is not as bad as the coffee table kind of horror. This is a horror because we're getting along for 30 minutes. She's so beautiful. I did not ask for her number and her favorite movie was Cinema Paradiso. So she walked straight out of my life. Story of my life. Had some really great memories of Cinema Paradiso. So this is one of my all-time favorite films as far as nostalgia level. Would have to do a rewatch. By the way, you guys will never see this, but the actual longer cut version is, I just did not like it one bit. I love this movie, Cinema Paradiso. 90% from critics, 96% from the mass, from cinephiles. I'm giving it 5 stars. Bruce Perky, your rating on Cinema Party. So I can say that because I've seen it 4 or 5 times, Bruce.
If I was generous, I would give it a star for every day it took me to finish the movie, which was 3. But I'm going to give it 2.
2 stars for Bruce Perky. Very good, Bruce. I respect that. Eric Holmes.
I think I'm on the same page. I'll give it 2.5.
Oh, you'd be nice.
Because there was there are like a couple like little tiny things in the first half of the movie, I probably give like 3.5-4 stars. The second half, I'd probably give like half a star because there was nothing in the second half that I cared about. You know, a lot of the crowd shots. Like the camera will just kind of be going through the crowd, and then all of a sudden, like there's a guy like just behind this woman, like just grabbing her breast, and she's like, "I was like, are they having sex right there?" They cut across. They show or was it they were playing Lolita, I think, or they were playing some movie, and they were focusing on a woman's butt, and then they cut to like a bunch of kids like. Down like right. this.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're doing something. They're not real explicit on what that is. And then the usher's like, "Hey, knock it off." And then he looks up and just kind of like plays with his pants. Like there's like little kind of, I guess, weird horny things in there that I thought was kind of funny. And yeah, I like the relationship. But man, that second half was rough to get through.
Okay, 5 stars for me, 2.5 from Eric Holmes, 2 stars from Bruce Berkey for Cinema Party. So that is very interesting. We are not going to, Bruce, you want to do a box pick, even though we're not going to do Patreon, or just going to do it next week?
We'll do it next week because I'll forget if I do.
Okay, fair enough. How dare both of you levy that rating. The coffee table you guys like better than Cinema Party. So final thoughts, Eric Holmes.
Well, I'm also the guy that thinks the Godfather movies are overrated. So take that into consideration as well. Okay. Check out everything we talked about today, even Cinema Parody. So if you must,
Bruce Perky, we're out. Go ahead.
I would just say if you want to be a little more successful than Greg was, you have to follow Cinema Parody. So, and you have to like creepily film her from behind some some bookshelves or something.
Do not do that.
Bruce, that is such a dig on Cinema Parody. I love you for that, man. All right, we'll see you here next week here on Cinematics. And of course, here's Claire.
Goodbye, everybody. Thank you for joining Cinematics.